We did last week. Yeah.
I was wondering if it's possible to clone density matrices.
No, the answer is no. But what do you mean by clone density matrices?
So I have a machine where, you know, a density matrix, a mixed state basically goes in.
So you stick in row.
And two copies of the mixed state comes up.
So what do you mean by two copies?
All right, yes.
So okay.
I mean, I wouldn't by two copies. I would mean. I mean, we know what a system in density state row is, and if we can identify a system in density state row, then to verify we have two copies, all we have to do is verify that each one is in density state row. No, if they're entangled, I guess that could be hard. But I guess we
right
have to be
right. Entangled. Well, okay. So, but let's take the most general version of that, where you say they can be entangled. We just want. So this third output state is going to be kind of junk. These are going to be the two copies. So we're going to call this overall some state psi. Well, it doesn't have to be psi. It can be some other density matrix, E of rho. OK? And so this is going to be output A, output B, output C. And so we'd like to say if we trace over B and C, well, that's equal to rho. So the output of system A would be rho. And if we trace over A and C, then the output should also be rho. OK? So this is kind of the weakest thing that you can still, in some sense, call making two copies of the density matrix rho. And the answer is no, it's not possible. And that's known as the no broadcasting theorem. And actually, you can see that it's not possible in general just by, well, for instance, if you put in a pure state input, right, it's clearly not going to be possible, because then doing this is just going to be the same as cloning. But you can put more constraints on exactly what is and is not possible. Now, clearly, if rho is diagonal in a known basis, then you can do this, because now it's a classical probability distribution. And what you can do is you can just say, well, I'm going to look at the particular thing in this basis and copy it. And you can do that in a known basis, right? That's just classical copying. And then, but then what you get is a correlated output state here. Was that going to be your question? No. Okay.
No, I don't think it's possible to copy a classical probability distribution.
Right. So this is the subtle distinction between copying the distribution and broadcasting the distribution. So what you can't do is, given one sample from a classical probability distribution, and generate another independent sample. So that would be the case where the output here would be rho tensor rho. But it certainly is possible to take one sample from classical probability distribution and tell it to lots of different people, right? Like, you know, that's what they do when they broadcast the lottery on TV, right? They draw a random number, and then they tell everybody. Okay? And what you get out there is not a tensor product, it's a correlated state, right? So it's a mixture of 0 for Alice, 0 for Bob, with 1 for Alice, 1 for Bob, 2 for Alice, 2 for Bob, all with the same probabilities that they appeared in the original distribution. Okay? But for general quantum states, even this weaker thing is not possible. Basically, you can only do it if you have a set of quantum states that set of possible density matrices that all commute with each other, which basically kind of boils it down to the classical case. Yeah?
You might be someone who knows the answer. So I guess we'll know that like states aren't really necessary if you're doing quantum mechanics. Like, all you really need is an algebra with derivables. Mm-hmm. And then like your states are going to be linear functionals, so they're positive, mm-hmm. blah, blah, blah. So like, because of the uncertainty principle, there are certain linear functionals that, like, they look like they're positive and linear and, what's the other one? I don't even remember. But they look, oh, right, they send the identity to 1. But they don't, because, like, the commutation relations make them inconsistent. Like, if I take the algebra x, phi, where
right.
they have the permutation relation, then like if I can totally assign a linear functional that sends like x to 0 and p to 0, and since x squared and p squared are like linearly independent, it seems like I can assign them independently, but if I send them both to 0 too, then it becomes inconsistent with the commutation. Mm-hmm. So my question is,
classically, right, so what do you mean by, oh, I see. So you're defining you're defining the algebra of operators as linear functionals.
I'm defining a state as a linear functional from operators to complex numbers.
A state, okay.
Certain properties, right.
Okay.
So classically, like if I am given an algebra of random variables, and you give me a state and ask me like, is it consistent? Like for example, if I have like x squared, x cubed, and so forth, I can tell you whether or not a given state is the set of Fermi problems essentially by like making some matrix and seeing like whether it has a certain property. Like there's a simple test to tell you whether my state is consistent. And that should, I suppose that test should tell me that like the state space is just the state of probability distributions. So I'm wondering what if there's an equivalent thing for quantum mechanics. Like is there a way for me to look at the state that assigns the variance of x and p to be small and immediately realize that it doesn't work?
Let me think. So classically, basically the algebra operators you could have should be a commuting one. Which kind of gives you a lot of freedom to do stuff. You look at a basis. I mean, you can think of the commuting algebra as a vector space. Look at a basis. Quantum mechanically, it's probably enough. I'm not sure if this is in general the case, but I would think it's enough to look at a maximum abelian sub-algebra.
Okay.
And if that's consistent, so you can define. Then you have kind of freedom on that.
Right.
In the same possible way, and then beyond that, I guess it doesn't define everything because it kind of doesn't tell you how the phases go. Yeah. So no. I mean, I bet there is some kind of condition, but I guess I'm not the right person.
Okay.
Okay. But is there quantum information questions? No. Okay. So then what I wanted to do today was to talk about, this week we're going to start talking about algorithms, quantum algorithms. And as a warm-up to that, I want to introduce you to basics of a classical complexity theory. And we'll do a little bit of classical algorithms tomorrow as well. But the motivation for complexity theory is to try to classify computational problems into hard problems and easy problems. And there's a lot of kind of conceptual barriers that come up along the way of doing this, and a couple of big practical barriers as well. So the big practical barriers is that we actually can't, when it gets right down to it, really definitively say some problems are hard and some problems are easy, except in very extreme cases. But people have built up a kind of conceptual framework to talk about these questions, and at least to make educated guesses. We can actually say that some problems are no easier than other problems, but in a lot of cases we can't say that they're definitively strictly harder. Okay, that's the practical issue. But the conceptual issue. So how do we classify hard versus easy? And again, this is for computational problems. So maybe the first thing that you think of is you say, well, how long does it take to solve this problem? How much time? So there's a couple of issues that arise when you think of this solution. First, you might say, Well, okay, it depends, you know, what algorithm you use to solve it, right? If you use a really stupid algorithm, it could take a long time. That's not because the problem is hard, but because you did something dumb. So that one is easy to fix. You say, okay, we'll use the best algorithm. But then there's another issue, which is, well, some computers are faster than other computers, right? And so the amount of time doesn't depend just on the problem. It also depends, as I said, on how you solve it. But it depends even on the machine in which you run it, right? And if you use it a really fast computer, it might, you know, even a problem that seems like it's really hard might only take a very short time. But of course, that is also relatively easy to solve. You say, well, okay, let's ignore some details of the machine. Fast versus slow, you know, still it'll take some number of computational steps. And maybe that computational step takes a nanosecond. Maybe it takes, you know, a second. But that's kind of a matter of the machine and not a matter of the problem. So let's say how many computational steps. So refine this to how many computational steps. And using the best algorithm. Okay. Okay, but this best algorithm thing is sweeping a fair amount under the rug. So what does it mean for the best algorithm? Right? Obviously, maybe finding the truly best algorithm is a subtle, difficult question. But let's just look at some, you know, relatively simple problem. Suppose you want to multiply a 100-digit number by a 100-digit number. Okay, this is something, you know, you learned how to do in elementary school. For 100-digit numbers, it would take you a long time by hand. The computer can do it very quickly. But maybe some 100-digit numbers are easier to multiply than other 100-digit numbers, right? That's certainly true. For instance, if you have, you know, 10 to the 100 times 10 to the 100, well, that doesn't take you long, right? That's just 10 to the 200. But if it's some, you know, basically just random digits, 100 random digits, well, then it seems like it should be much more harder, much more difficult. But maybe you wrote an algorithm that really liked these particular 100-digit numbers, and it had, you know, a table that said, well, if we have this particular 100-digit number times this particular 100-digit number, here's the answer. And if anything else, then we'll do it the hard way, or the not very hard, but harder way. Okay? So that would suggest that those two particular 100-digit numbers were easy to multiply together, and the general case was more difficult. But that's silly, right? It's just you've chosen a very specialized algorithm that moved all the work into writing the algorithm for multiplying these particular 100-digit numbers, and is not actually doing anything when it comes right down to it. So this is a problem that afflicts any attempt to say, well, here's a very particular computational problem. What's its difficulty? If you look at a very specific example with all the, you know, all the details specified, well, it has an answer, that problem. And if you pre-computed that, you can write an algorithm that'll calculate the answer very quickly. Right? So the upshot of this is we can't really define the difficulty of a single problem. So instead, we should look at classes of problems. So what I mean by this is we can't say what is the difficulty of multiplying 54 times 73. We should say what is the difficulty of multiplying two numbers together. even saying, what is the difficulty of multiplying 200-digit numbers together, that's too specific. Because you could have a big table, it has to be a very big table, but one that lists all pairs of 100-digit numbers, and then you just look that up. So it's not really doing the work of multiplication, that algorithm. And it wouldn't work for 101-digit numbers. Okay? So when we do this, we have to really look at infinite classes of problems. Classes of problems where the inputs can get arbitrarily large. So in computer science terminology, let's see. We talk about languages and decision problems. Okay. So let's do some definitions. So this is common notation. 0, 1, you know what that is. It's a set of 0 and 1. But when I put a star on it, that means it's bit strings of arbitrary length. And in a language is a subset and we say that an algorithm A of x, which is kind of a simplification. I just mean in this case that this algorithm computes this function A of x on input x. We say that it decides a language. Language L if A of x is equal to 0, if and only if x is not in L, and A of x equals 1 whenever x is in L. Okay? And in a case like in something like this, we say that x is an instance of L. So okay, so it's worth explaining these definitions and the motivations behind them. Okay, so a language is just a subset of bit strings, right? So it's some set of bit strings of arbitrary length. So what this is supposed to do is supposed to encode some sort of problem. But it's supposed to encode a decision problem. So the example I was using before of multiplication, that's not a decision problem, because you have two long inputs, but the output is, again, some long bit string. So a decision problem so given two numbers, x1 and x2, and so then, for instance, we can ask, is the last bit of x1 times x2 equal to 1? So that's a decision problem. Okay. So this is kind of a decision problem that relates to multiplication. It's not all of multiplication. To make it multiplication, you'd have a third input that specified which bit of the answer you were interested in, instead of just the last bit. But if you can solve multiplication, you can certainly solve this problem. And you see, this is a decision problem because it has a yes or no answer. And what that corresponds to as a language is we say, well, what we're going to do is we're going to concatenate together x1 and x2. And the bit string that basically consists of this is in L if and only if the last bit of x1 times x2 is 1. Okay? So the things that are, the bit strings that are in the language is correspond to the yes instances, right? So those are the case where we get a yes answer to this question. And the bit strings that are not in the language are the no instances. Okay? Now, I mean, obviously there's some subtleties for how you encode these bit strings in this language, right? In this case, we needed to write a pair of bit strings, a pair of numbers, as one long bit string. You can imagine all sorts of ways of doing this. And if you study, you know, the details of modern computers, then there's, you know, there's actual concrete ways it's done in reality. But we won't really need to worry about that for reasons that I'll get to in a minute. But does everyone understand kind of the idea of a language and why it's defined this way? And what it means to decide a language then is to answer whether or not this bit string is in the language, whether it's a yes instance or a no instance. So that's why it corresponds to answering this type of question. Does everyone get that? Yeah.
The difference between the definition and the example. Now we require that x be an instance of L. But now we have some like two bit strings, x1 and x2. And
right.
Are we supposed to separate x1 for x2 be instance of L?
No. So in this case, what I'm doing is I'm imagining that there's some sort of encoding that takes pairs of bit strings and writes them as one long bit string. So we can't answer this question, obviously. So okay, you could ask a different question, which would say, is the last bit of either one of them one? Right. In that case, it wouldn't matter kind of which one. But the point is, it's a pair, and the pair is inherent to this question, that you need both of them to really talk about it. So a natural way of encoding this would be you start out with some kind of code in this bit string that says how long the two numbers are that we're multiplying together. And then you can just write them. And because you know how long each one is, you know where the break between them is. Okay, so that would be the kind of encoding that I'm talking about. So you have to have some kind of encoding for this to make sense. And it turns out that that we want to define the difficulty of languages in such a way that it's not too sensitive to the details of exactly how you do that encoding. And of course, the motivation for different languages will want to encode different kinds of things, right? So we might want to ask about words. So we might want to say, given this word, is the first letter A, right? And then we need some kind of encoding that encodes letters into bit strings. For instance, that's fairly standard. You know, computers use, say, ASCII. Or you might want to write some more complicated mathematical formula. You know, for all x, there exists a y such that blah, 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 blah. Okay, and so then you need some way of encoding that type of mathematical formula into bit strings. And you know, maybe you can do that again by, you know, you write it in tech and then you put the tech into as that's just characters, you put that into ASCII, and then that's a long bit string. But the point is, anything, I mean, when you work with computers, the inner guts of computers at all, you get used to the idea that basically anything you want to say can be put into a bit string with some sort of encoding. And that's what we have to do in order to start to talk about these languages in this way. Yeah?
Is there a motivation why we call this thing a language?
I think there is. It dates back from the early history of theoretical computer science. I don't know the history well enough to really answer that. I don't think so. Actually, I think it has more to do with natural languages, and as in there's ways of saying certain things, and there's grammatical rules you have to follow, stuff like that. I think that's closer to history, but I don't know for sure. Do you know?
This was something we went over in one of my classes. A lot of the early structure of this kind of thing came from Noam Chomsky and others having a project to try and encode human languages and logical structures.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay. Actually, so the example I had on my sheet was an easier one, maybe. You don't have to worry so much about the encoding. So here's another example. So in this language, we're supposed to test whether number is prime or not. So numbers now are just going to be integers, or even positive integers. So, and then the language itself consists of those positive integers, which are prime. Okay? So the yes instances are the prime numbers, and the no instances are the composite numbers. I guess and 1 would count here as a non-prime. Okay? Okay. So now we'd like to know whether language is easy to decide or hard to decide. And so we've got off to the right start, because now we're looking at a class of problems, right? And it's potentially an infinite class. Like, primality testing is certainly infinite, right? Well, we know there's an infinite number of primes. It's not, there's a lot of things we know about primes, a lot of things we don't know about primes. But one of the things we know is that there's an infinite number of them. Again, we have to be careful, because we don't want to define the difficulty in terms of any single running time, right? Because we could write an algorithm that, you know, has a list of a whole bunch of primes, and so it knows that those things are prime. But then, you know, once you get outside of that list, it doesn't know what to do, and then it takes a long time. So what we could really do is we have to kind of take into account the infinite nature of this class and really use that in our definition of hard. So in particular, what we like to do is consider the asymptotic behavior of the algorithm for large numbers. And in particular, we want to consider as a function of the length of the number. So this notation means the length of x, okay, the number of bits in x. And while this thing will vary if you use different encodings, presumably it's not going to vary too much, right? Things that are really, really complicated long numbers will still be really, really complicated long numbers, even if maybe they're twice as long or half as long. There are some exceptions to this, and so you have to, when you get into really serious computer science, you have to be very careful about exactly what you're putting into the encoding so that you don't make it too strong. But I'm going to basically ignore that. Okay, so because, for instance, the encodings can be different, or maybe you can use a different algorithm that'll have some different properties, we still have to be careful even with this definition. It's not enough just to look at the asymptotic behavior. And in particular, if you have two different computers, well, they can easily differ in the computational difficulty, in the number of computational steps. Due, for instance, to different architectures. So, for example, if you consider a one-dimensional computer, right, where all the bits are laid out on a line, versus a two-dimensional computer, where they're laid out, say, on a grid, two-dimensional grid, Well, this one, it seems like it could be considerably more powerful than this, right? Because for this, if you want to interact two bits that are at the far ends of the line, well, you have to move one of them all the way over, or copy it over or something. And that will take a minimum of n steps just to do that. And then maybe you want to have it talk to something that's all the way back on the other end, so it has to go all the way back. So everything you do could take n steps as long. Whereas in this, the maximum distance you ever have to move is roughly square root of n. Right? Or for instance, if you had full or even full connectivity, so you had fast wires that connected any bit with any other bit, well, then you could get a factor of n speed up. If you went from the 1D to this full connectivity computer. Okay? So, even looking at the asymptotic behavior is not enough, because we still have some variation in exactly what kind of machine we have. And we don't want to have to worry about this. Right? We don't want to say that this computational problem, well, it's hard on a PC, but it's easy on a Mac. We don't want to have to do that. And because then somebody might say, oh, well, I've designed a new computer, and this problem is even easier on that one. So what we're going to do is we're going to kind of sweep even this under the rug and talk about even more fine-grained behavior. So in particular, in order to define complexity, well, we're going to look at polynomial versus exponential. So let's see. So a complexity class is any set of languages. So that doesn't say whether this is a sensible complexity class to think about or not. You can talk about the complexity class of languages whose best algorithms take, time 5n to the 3/2 on, some particular type of computer. It has to be, obviously, a computer that can work on arbitrarily large inputs, because otherwise it's not well defined. But beyond that, that's a complexity class that you can define. It's not a very sensible complexity class because it's very tied to this particular type of computer. So a complexity class that's very nice, one that we work with quite a lot, is the class P. And so P stands for polynomial time. And it's the class set of languages which can be decided in polynomial time on some particular type of machine still, but it's called a Turing machine. It's kind of a standard model of computation. But it turns out that this class P doesn't depend so much on exactly what you put in here. So you can define a Turing machine. You can say, well, I want a circuit, a network of classical gates. And that'll work fine. It'll give you the same class of languages. The point is, as you move to different types of classical computers, well, the time it takes to solve any given algorithm might vary by polynomial difference, but it'll still stay polynomial if it is polynomial. And if it's not polynomial, well, it won't be polynomial on the other computer. Okay? So this is kind of a robust complexity class. Yeah?
Is there a way to design a Turing machine such that, this might be confusing, but a language in a polynomial time class actually will take like exponential or multiple types?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. So, I mean, you can have, yeah. So, sorry. So this could really be what's called a universal Turing machine. So there's certainly stupid Turing machines, which, you know, do. So you can write a Turing machine basically. A Turing machine encodes kind of a Turing machine encodes a particular algorithm, in fact, when you get right down to it. And so then a universal Turing machine is kind of a programmable algorithm. It's the analog of a programmable computer, where part of the input tells it what program to run. And then it spends the rest of the time doing that. So it's kind of a compiler. If you choose a non-universal Turing machine, then it's certainly possible that you can you can give it a language that's in P, but it could still take an exponential time to decide. So actually, I realize I haven't been totally precise about what this means. So when we say polynomial time, that means time less than or equal to f of n on input sizes n. So that's this length of the bit string. And for some polynomial f. So this could be for large inputs. So it has to be less than this. It has to be bounded by this polynomial for large inputs. So it might be, again, that there's some particular values for which, you know, we can do very quickly. Like, you know, multiplying 100-digit numbers together. If it happens to be 10 to the 100, 10 times 10 to the 100, we can take a shortcut and do it very quickly. But in general, we have to use the full algorithm. And what this is saying is that for any particular language in this class, there must be some polynomial where the algorithm finishes. But then there's going to be another language that needs a bigger polynomial. So for instance, you know, we have one algorithm that takes time order n squared, and then another algorithm that takes time order n cubed, another problem, I should say, another language that might take time order n cubed, and yet another one that takes time order n to the 27th. Okay. And those are all still in this class P. Okay. And of course, there's some languages that are not in P. So for instance, we can define this class X, which of course stands for exponential time. And that's the set of languages which run in time less than or equal to, actually, it's exponential of a polynomial. And it turns out the reason you need this polynomial inside is, again, because of these issues that when you change from one machine to another, you might change the behavior by some polynomial. And unfortunately, it shows up on the inside here rather than the outside. This could also relate to the different encodings, for instance, of the input. Okay. Right. So then, one more complexity class for the moment, which is a very important one called NP. So this, unfortunately, NP does not stand for not polynomial. It stands for non-deterministic. Polynomial. And the reason for that is because it was originally defined in terms of some perverse object called a non-deterministic Turing machine, which is not non-deterministic in the sense of quantum mechanics being non-deterministic, but in some other totally physically unrealistic sense. But it's still a very interesting class. So basically, it's the set of things that can be checked in polynomial time. So it's a class of languages L such that, so it can, like I said, it can be checked in polynomial time. So there's going to be some verification function v of xw. So it takes two inputs. One of those inputs is the question, the instance of L that we're considering. And the other is called the witness. And the witness is supposed to, well, testify that X really is in the language. So that means we need two properties. So first of all, it means that when X actually is in the language, then there exists W. And W should be at most polynomially long in X. Okay, and well, then this verification function, when fed X and W, should say, yes, this is a valid witness for this language X, and therefore X is in the language. Sorry, for this is a valid witness W for this instance X, and therefore X is in the language. Okay, so that's the yes case. And we also need something for the no case. So that says that if X is not in L, then for all polynomial length W, this checking algorithm should reject. So it says, so X presents itself with this witness W, and the checking algorithm compares them, does whatever it has to do, and says, no, sorry, that doesn't work. OK? So that means that the yes instances of L can be checked with the help of a witness. Yeah.
Why do we need the witness to check whether X is an instance of L? We know that we can always find, from this definition, we can always find the function that tells whether X is an instance of L.
That's right. Oh, I'm sorry. I left out something very, very important. So this checking function must run in polynomial time. Okay, so that's the answer. So there is always going to be an algorithm that determines whether X is in the language or not, without any additional help. But that algorithm might be a really, really long one. And the advantage of a problem in NP is that, well, it might take a very long time to determine by yourself whether X is in the language or not. With the help of this witness, we can check the yes instances in polynomial time. Okay, thank you. It's very important. That's the whole point of this class. Okay, that it contains things that could be outside P, so there's no quick algorithm to decide them by themselves, but within polynomial time, you can check at least the yes instances. Yeah?
I'm sort of confused about the requirements for the length of W.
Okay.
Why, like, I guess the first question is, why do they matter? And the second question is, should I...
Okay, so let me answer the first question first.
Yeah.
The main reason it matters is because of this. Okay, so when I say it runs in polynomial time, it means it runs in a time that's polynomial in the length of the total input you're providing this function, which is the length of X plus the length of W. So if you let W be very, very long, then, well, polynomial time in the length of W might still be exponential time in the length of X. So that's cheating. And it's also true going the other way around, which is that if v really runs only in polynomial time in the length of x, well, it can only even access polynomially many bits of w. So if w were exponentially long, but v was still, you know, a quick algorithm, well, then it wouldn't help.
know X and the corresponding W?
That's right. So why don't I give an example of an NP problem?
Yeah.
And then we can get back to that. Was that okay? So okay. So so actually, well, this is so maybe before I do this, this problem that I showed you, multiplying, this is actually in polynomial time. So this problem is in P. This problem, it turns out, is in P also. That's extremely non-obvious. And the deterministic algorithm for that was only discovered a few years ago, actually by a professor in India working with two undergrads. Now, there was a randomized algorithm for doing this some years ago. But there's an interesting story there. But in any case, it's not even totally obvious that this problem is in NP. You need some number theory to do that. Because, well, somebody presents with a composite number, well, that's certainly easy to prove, right? Because you can say, well, here are the factors. But if somebody presents you with a number and says, this is prime, well, how do you prove that? It turns out there is a way to do that. And there's a long, interesting history of algorithms studying this particular question. But this one is going to be much easier to understand, why it's in NP. So what this is it consists of Boolean expressions. In what's called conjunctive normal form. So what does that mean? Well, it means that we can break it up as the and is conjunction, of a bunch of clauses. Okay, and each clause involves k variables. That's why it's k satisfiability. And is the OR of either each variable or not of the variable. OK? So what I mean, for instance, we could have say x1 or not x2 or x7. That's a valid clause for 3-sat, right? Because there's 3 variables that show up. And I should say it's actually less than or equal to k variables. It doesn't have to be exactly k. Okay, and each variable can show up many times in the course of this formula. That's perfectly fine. So this is the description of the instances of k satisfiability, and then we say a certain formula is in ksat. So it's a yes instance. If there exists an assignment of variables so that saying x1 is equal to something, x2 is equal to something, x3 is equal to something, and so on, such that the formula evaluates to true. Okay? So maybe an even more concrete example of second instance. So you might have x1 or x2 or not x3, and x1, well, let's make it more interesting. Let's say not x1 or x2 or x3. So this is satisfiable, and there's a couple of ways to satisfy it. Suppose we were to set x1 to be true. Well, then this clause is satisfied. This clause, well, the first part is not satisfied, but we still have two other chances. So for instance, we can send x2 is equal to true. And then x3 we can let to be whatever we want. OK? So maybe this also indicates to you why it's an NP, right? So this was a yes instance, and I proved it to you by showing you an assignment to the variables. So that's the witness, right? So I guess maybe I should go over here. OK, so in other words, ksat is in NP. Witness is a satisfying assignment. OK, so It's perhaps worth noting here that there's this asymmetry in the definition of NP, which is that for the yes instances, we need there to be a witness. But for the no instances, we don't. Okay, and you can see that happening here, right? Because if you have a formula that is satisfiable, well, it's easy to prove that by showing the satisfying assignment. But if you have a formula that's not satisfiable, well, it's not clear how you would prove that. Right? I mean, you could show an assignment that doesn't satisfy, but maybe you just picked a dumb assignment. Maybe there's a better one that does work. That's right. But the number of assignments is, each variable can have two possible values. And there's n variables, so there's 2 to the n possible assignments that you'd have to check. So that's an exponential witness n checking algorithm. OK, so you had a question about the definition or the motivation or something. But OK, OK, good.
Is it really necessary to say that the length of W is probably an x? Like, could I just say
It would be enough to say that V runs in polynomial time in the length of x.
Yes, OK.
And that would work just OK. I just wanted to be more explicit.
This function b, is there a natural way of constructing it, given the...
Not necessarily. I mean, that's something... So it that's something that's going to depend on the specific language. Okay, and that can be extremely subtle. So in this case, for case satisfiability, there was kind of an obvious algorithm. But, well, I erased it now. But primality testing is an example where the algorithm is not so obvious. Right? So if you just look at that problem, you have to do some work to show that it's in NP. And you have to know a little bit of number theory to do that. Yeah? So the witness is a satisfying assignment. And then the checking algorithm is, well, you try out the satisfying assignment. You evaluate the formula with that assignment of variables. And if it's true, then yes, that's a valid satisfying assignment, and it's a yes instance. right? So that answers the one. Okay. But if somebody shows you a potential witness, they say, here's a satisfying assignment, and you check, and it's a no instance, right? Then whatever satisfying assignment they show you, when you check it out, you'll get the thing will evaluate to false, right? Because that's the definition of the problem, that it's not in there if every assignment gives false. Okay? So that gives us number two. So that proves it's an NP. Okay. Okay. So. Okay. So now we'd like to kind of work towards the notion of how we talk about a problem being hard. So it's a famous open question whether P is equal to NP. And the answer is probably not. And there's various reasons that people think that they're not equal. For instance, well, we've tried really hard to solve the hardest problems in NP, and we haven't succeeded. But there's more sophisticated theoretical computer science arguments that I won't go into. This remains an open question, and it's the biggest open question in computer science, and one of the biggest open questions in all of mathematics. And part of the problem is we don't really have good techniques to prove that problems are hard. So this remains open, but we can still say that some things appear to be hard, and part of that is because we think that P is not equal to NP. So for instance, we can say that if P is not equal to NP, then this problem must be hard. Well, how do we say something like that? Well, to do that, we have to define the notion of reduction in complete languages. So we say that a language L reduces to another language M if so there exists some polytime function mapping bit strings to bit strings. Such that if x is in L, then that implies that f of x is in M. And of course, if x is not in L, then f of x should not be in M. OK? So. So what does this definition mean? It means that if we can solve M, if L reduces to M, then if we can solve M, then we can also solve L. And by solve, I mean decide. Okay, why is that? Well, suppose somebody gives us an instance of L. Well, then what we can do is we can stick it into this function f, right? So we're given x, and we want to know whether it's in L or not. So we stick it into f. We get f of x, and then we know how to decide m. Right? So we decide M. We say, is f of x in M or not in M? And then we can work backwards, right? If f of x is in M, then that meant that x must have been in L. And if f of x is not in M, then that means x was not in L. OK? So. I find this definition a little confusing sometimes because it seems kind of backwards to me. Because what it means is that the language M is at least as hard as L, right? Because if you can solve M, then you can solve L. So that means that you're reducing languages to harder languages. So it's reduced in the case of we have now reduced to a previously solved case, rather than we have now reduced the difficulty by making it easier. Okay? And then we can define this notion of a complete language. So we can have a complete language for complexity class C if for all, let's make it M. M is the complete language. If for all L in this complexity class, L reduces to M. OK. Question.
Obvious to me why every complexity class should have languages which are complete for that class.
Right. Well, in general, let's see. So I'm not a complexity theorist enough to answer the kind of the technical details of this question. So the following I know is true, which is there are complexity classes that don't have natural complete languages. Okay, so some complexity classes have very nice complete languages. And that's a useful property of that complexity classes. Some complexity classes, it's possible they have complete languages, but only weird, artificial, made-up ones that are kind of made up with the definition of the class in mind. So basically, in practice, we only talk about completeness for certain complexity classes, the ones where it's kind of an interesting complete language. So we're running out of time. So let me just say one more final theorem. I should say that there's other notions of reduction that are kind of conceptually similar, but technically slightly different. This is a simple one, and it's good enough for our purposes. And I want to finish by stating a theorem. This is the Cook-Levin theorem, and is really one of the main theorems of complexity theory. And what it says is that this problem 3-sat is NP complete. In other words, 3-sat is one of the hardest languages in NP, because if you could decide 3-sat, then you could decide any other language in NP. Okay? So P versus NP comes down to the question of, is 3-sat in P or not? Does it have a polynomial time algorithm? And for the tutorial today, you'll prove this Cook-Levin theorem, or at least go through the sketch of the proof. Yeah.
It looks as though L reduces to M and M reduces to L are equivalent statements.
L reduces to M and M reduces to L. Yes, they're different statements.
Right. What makes them different?
Because this function doesn't have to be a bijection.
Okay.
So it could be that there's some instances of M that you can't kind of go backwards to find an instance of L. But for every instance of L, you can go forwards to find an instance of M. Yeah.
If you don't mind me promoting a resource on it.
Okay, sure.
When I'm at the heading zoom on the complexity zoo, it has a goes over a lot of this and some other classes that's meant for.
It goes over the easy ones like NP?
Yeah.
So online there's a wiki, I guess it's now a format called the Complexity Zoo. And Chris says there's a subsection that focuses on kind of the most the most interesting complexity classes like NP. Okay, and I'm sure you can find it by the focus.
I'll put the link on the
Okay, good. Okay, thanks.